Have you ever seen or heard a ghost?
The fact is, 22% of us, if you look at the polls, believe we've had some sort of, you know, ghostly experience. So if one in five people are walking around thinking that something like this has happened to them, we should be able to talk about it in a serious sort of way.
We talked to Volk about his fascinating book, Fringeology. In it, he applies his journalist's objective eye to the world of paranormal phenomena. And summer vacation is coming up, a time when kids go down the summer slide. And I don't mean the water slide or the playground slide.
Kids stop learning, they watch TV, they're playing games, they're playing sports, which are all great activities. But there are ways to turn your regular summer activities into a learning opportunity, and they don't realize they're learning.
That's teacher Kim Tredick. We talked to her about the summer slide and one way to prevent it. Then we hear Drew Adamick's review of the novel The Hunger Angel by Herta Müller. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A Gallup poll from 2006 found that 3 in 4 Americans believe in one or more paranormal phenomena, like ESP, ghosts, telepathy, and clairvoyance. Many of those, including myself, have had paranormal experiences. I don't think of myself as a credulous person. I believe firmly in the scientific method, that is, basing conclusions on randomly assigned experimental evidence. And I share the ingrained skepticism of most journalists. But I also can't deny the evidence of my own experience. I've had 2 outstanding brushes with the paranormal and countless minor ones. I had a clairvoyant vision of the Twin Towers collapsing about 10 years before it happened. And, as you'll hear later, I also had a close encounter with a dark disembodied entity that I simply cannot explain. My guest, Steve Volk, shares a similar history. As he says on his blog, his book Fringeology is his attempt to reconcile a mysterious ghost story from his own childhood with his lifelong down-to-earth occupation as a journalist. His solution was to do journalism, to investigate that family ghost story and other paranormal topics. He writes, "What I found is a great tale that's been relegated to the fringe of our discourse for too long. A story filled with ghosts, UFOs, maverick scientists, psychics, spoonbenders, and the people who love and hate them. More importantly," he says, "I found common ground we can all share, a place for skeptics and believers, spiritualists and scientists, to stand together, not at the fringes, but at the heart of what it means to be human." Steve Volk is a city reporter for Alt Weeklies in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and for Philadelphia Magazine. Steve Volk, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Fringeology seems to be the first book that I've seen that really tries to take a journalist's open-minded look at the phenomenon of the paranormal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to jump in, I mean, I think that there's almost a sort of an unspoken prohibition against looking into it. I just think that, you know, one, only so many people would be interested meeting reporters. Number two, if you are interested, you have to check your, you know, just sort of your career status and consider how important it really is to you, I think.
Yeah, you had a real conundrum that you faced there. Why was that?
You know, I'm a guy who's, I'm sitting right here now actually in Philadelphia in an office at Philadelphia Magazine with 2 really big filing cabinets filled with notes and court records and documentable, verifiable facts and, you know, paranormal claims are thought to exist way outside of that sort of territory, right? So it's a bridge too far, I think, in the traditional journalistic way of looking at things. It's, you know, silly, ephemeral. It's just the sort of ghost hunting story you do at Halloween, and everybody has a mild chuckle about it, and you write it kind of with your tongue in your cheek and in a sort of a gentle mocking tone so the reader doesn't think, you know, you're falling for this stuff. And, you know, the problem for me was, you know, sort of throughout my life and career is that I would always read these things and feel a twinge of, you know, I should do something about this. I should do something that runs in the other direction and takes these things seriously so far as they go, because of the ghost story I was carrying around from my own childhood.
Yeah, so let's start there. You do talk about that early in the book, and then you come back to it. What happened to you as a child?
It's a fairly outlandish story. I mean, I was around 5 or 6 years old when it all happened, so I have fragmentary memories of it all. But there was a really loud, booming sound, thudding sound, that would happen in the middle of the night. My sisters down the hall thought it was coming from up in the walls of their room. And then my brother and I on the other side of the house, we didn't share an adjoining wall, thought it was coming from the roof over our heads. And it would seem to at times, you know, move around to us. And my parents downstairs, it was so loud that my parents downstairs were also woken up by it. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you know, they looked for prosaic explanations. I think one of the problems I have with kind of the state of modern skepticism is they think that people hear a weird sound and they go, oh, ghost. And look, in my ghost hunting, you know, sort of travels that I did from the book, I mean, I did find some people who did react that way. And I was very quickly able to debunk sort of what it was that they were reporting. But lots and lots of people spend many, many weeks and months, if not longer, looking for more mundane explanations. And my family fell into that category. My parents, you know, thought about things like water hammers. And, you know, and then it quickly becomes apparent that that sort of typical plumbing problem wasn't going to be the explanation, because the noise went on far longer than any kind of water hammer would. I mean, it would go on for minutes, tens of minutes. It would happen way high up in the walls. The pipes on the second floor only went up part of the way into the wall. There was just no way, you know, that these things were the explanation. They tried to recreate the noise. They wondered if somehow one of us was doing something. They would bang on our headboards in various rooms and see if somehow, you know, we were creating the noise. They would open and close closet doors, you know what I mean? Like, really roughly, trying to figure out, well, if I just keep opening and closing, does that sound like, you know, they couldn't find anything that accounted for it. And so they got tired, ultimately, of being woken up out of bed by this. And they were troubled because my sisters were reporting more dramatic things than that banging kind of noise. My sisters were saying that blankets were being pulled from their beds in the middle of the night. My sisters were saying that, you know, an old woman walked through the room, that the bed frame would shake in the middle of the night, like somebody was grabbing both, you know, the posts of the bed and twisting it left and right, you know, as violently as they could. So I think that my parents were simultaneously, you know, dismissive of that sort of story because they weren't encountering that directly and they didn't want to believe it was true, but I do think it also affected them. And so ultimately, when they couldn't come up for an explanation, even for the noise itself, my dad went and talked to the family priest. And the family priest came over and he blessed the house. And when he did, I'll never forget this, he turned to my dad as he left and said, you know, so this wasn't like a full-blown exorcism, don't get confused, you know. This is me talking, not the priest. This was the way Catholics do when they move into a house, the priest will come over and bless it. So he agreed to come over and do a blessing ceremony. In fact, it was his idea when my dad told him what was happening. So he comes over and he blesses the house, and on his way out the door he says to my dad, hey, you know, so long, Jerry, I'm sure everything will be fine. But the fact is, that night, the noise actually went on longer and louder than ever. And for the first time ever, it really assumed a precise location. Instead of coming from this amorphous sort of position somewhere up in the house, it hit at the top of the stairs, and then it came down one step at a time, like a child throwing a tantrum, is how my dad describes it. And when it hit the bottom, that was it, and we never heard it again.
Wow, that's such an amazing story. You must have been terrified.
I have some vague memories of that last night when it was going on in a really sort of fierce way. What's been even more moving to me since then, though, is hearing my family talk about it, in particular my parents. I mean, I conducted a real sort of formal interview of them at one point, and they were still freaked out by that event. My mom's color changed, you know what I mean? Like, they were sort of white-faced, they held hands across the table. They were still very bothered by it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can imagine that, and actually, I've had I don't think I've ever seen a ghost, but I've seen something that I could not understand. And I'm saying this, I know, at the risk of people thinking me a wacko, because this is where you go in this. But
Let me jump in, because that was when I said earlier that, you know, I would read these sorts of stories where, you know, there's a standard template kind of journalistic story on this sort of thing, and the kind of gentle mockery that's associated with it, and I'd have that twinge of, you know, I should do something different. I should do something about this and see if there's a way to cover these things in just sort of the standard journalistic way I'd cover something else that's presumed to be a serious topic. What you just said is the reason I wanted to do it, the main reason. I mean, there's lots of reasons. But it should not be that what are ultimately very common stories are so stigmatized that we feel afraid to share them. So that's a huge motivation for me in writing Fringeology, and a huge motivation behind the book. You know, whether it turns out that ghosts are some sort of disembodied spirit, or there's some sort of exotic, naturalistic kind of explanation available, the fact is 22% of us, if you look at the polls, believe we've had some sort of, you know, ghostly experience. So if 1 in 5 people are walking around thinking that something like this has happened to them, we should be able to talk about it in a serious sort of way and with no mockery associated with it. This is just part of the human condition, and we need to accept that. And I think that, again, to take this back to, you know, one of my problems with kind of modern skepticism is that on one hand they'll say, well, yes, it is part of the human condition, and it has to do with our, you know, our tendency towards superstition and to misperceive, you know, natural events. The problem is that they, number one, they have this sort of one-size-fits-all explanation. I don't think superstition and creaking floorboards are enough to explain ghosts by a long shot, right? So that's problem number one. They're just wrong. Problem number two is that ultimately their tone does become one of at least gentle mockery, if not outright disdain at times.
Well, you actually say in the book, Steve Volk, in Fringeology, that the skeptics don't follow their own precepts of, you know, rigorous scientific examination of the facts. And, you know, I'd like to come back to my story a little bit later, but let's follow this thread through here, because I think this gets to the heart of something you say in the book about how we human beings accept or don't accept things that we understand, and that it's actually biologically encoded in us. Talk about parapsychology, how rigorous the experiments have been around that, and how it's been treated by the skeptics, and why, what's going on here?
I think that when you say parapsychology, I'm going to use the term, you know, sort of telepathy or psi research. So, and by the way, the numbers for psi are far higher. I mean, depending on the poll, somewhere between 25% and 40% of us believe we've obtained information outside the normal sensory channels that was accurate. And, you know, that sixth sense idea. And the research that's been done on it is really, really well executed, and it meets the standards of ordinary sort of psychological research with, you know, double-blind protocols and this sort of thing. And there's lots of different areas that people have, kinds of tests that people have run. And what seems to show up persistently is not anything that would support the kind of star psychic like a John Edward, right, or an Alison Dubois. What shows up a lot in research is a small telepathic effect. You and I each having the ability to be right a little more often than chance would suggest. So if we're supposed to pick which of 4 face cards is going to show up, right, we would have a 1 in 4 chance or 25% chance of being right. But again and again, if you do enough trials, it seems to be that you find 28%, 29%, 32%, you know. Something that's not staggering, but in a statistical sense, is hugely significant in that scientific statistical sense.
And you point out that parapsychologists have been, precisely because they've been so marginalized, they go way overboard to ensure that their studies are rigorously done.
For the most part, at this point, they do their studies at a really high level of rigor, right? And a lot of the skeptics themselves will sort of be pushed to admit this. I quote, you know, Richard Wiseman and Chris French in the book, two of the leading skeptics. French in particular, I have very high respect for. They will come out and say that by the standards of any ordinary science, you know, telepathy is proven. They'll admit that this evidence is really good. They then sweep in, though, and sort of say that the problem is this isn't an ordinary claim, right? This is not an ordinary scientific claim. Parapsychologists are saying there's a sense that exists that we don't understand or have the foggiest clue how it works yet. We don't understand the mechanism by which telepathy would be possible, and therefore it's an extraordinary claim, and so we need extraordinary evidence. And so meeting the normal standards of rigor in a average psychological test is not good enough. We need more. And that's where I think the worldviews have sort of come in when you brought up neurology before. I mean, and I think the brain is sort of hardwired, right? When we encounter information that conflicts with how we take the world to work, and this could be, you know, an evangelical Christian, or it could be a hardcore skeptic like a Richard Wiseman. When we hear information that conflicts with that worldview, our amygdala fires, right? The center of the brain that processes fear and a lot of other things as well, but it's generally our warning center. It tells us that something's wrong. And when that kicks in, a lot of other, you know, physical effects are associated with that, anxiety, heart racing, all these kinds of things. And the natural inclination is to find some way to explain away what you're hearing that conflicts with your worldview.
So what you're saying is we're hardwired to reject things because we are afraid of what we don't understand. And so
we're threatened by it, right? We're afraid of it. And so there's a natural inclination to be defensive. Richard Wiseman hears that somebody is saying that telepathy exists, and he has, at this point, you know, a career interest tied up in 20 years of work as a skeptic and all the emotions associated with that to defending that line in the sand that telepathy does not exist. It was incredibly human and natural for Richard Wiseman to want to find a way to explain away whatever evidence does exist.
And you can
and that's
say
just who we are. And we need to understand that about ourselves. And, you know, and look, on the pro-parapsychology side, it would be natural for one of those people to dismiss Richard Wiseman as a crank. And I think that we need to start coming at this conversation first like some for a kind of position of humility, right, where we get about ourselves that we're going to invest a lot of emotion in this, and emotion is going to color our ability to look at the data to some degree. And we need to accept that going in and be respectful of the people that we're speaking to out of understanding our own deficiency in that way and being compassionate about theirs, knowing that their emotions are kicking in here too.
And then nonetheless, we can't just say, because I think it's easy to interpret what you've just said as saying, well, you know, there's right on both sides and therefore we can't ever really tell. But what you're saying is keep an open mind, not just because of you want to have a dialogue with opponents, but because we don't know everything.
Right. And we need to maintain that stance so that when new data arrives, we're able to look at it with, you know, a great degree, hopefully, of rationality.
So let's get back to your book, Steve Volk. It's Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable. You have a very fascinating chapter about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Remind our listeners who Kubler-Ross is and the journey that she went on from respected scientist to something a bit less than that.
Kubler-Ross is one of the most famous psychologists in history. She wrote the book On Death and Dying, which formalized a set of stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and really changed the way we relate throughout not just this country, but the world, to the terminally ill. And so back in the 60s, when she was working in a Chicago hospital as a psychologist and started noticing that, incredibly, patients were often non-informed of their terminal diagnosis. They didn't receive, at times, you know, they wouldn't receive visitors to the degree that you'd think they would. People were sort of shunning them. And the hospital staff even appeared to shun them. Nurses would spend as little time in their rooms as possible, darting in and out, avoiding eye contact. Doctors, too, you know, would avoid coming in. It was the taboo, right, of death. And our own innate fear of it, so great that even professional doctors and nurses couldn't bear to face it and actually have open, honest conversations with people about where they were in their life cycle, right? And so she started visiting with the terminally ill and recording everything it was that they had to say and take notes on all this. And also diagnosing, as I said, you know, the doctors and nurses and the family members and everybody's role in this. So an incredible piece of work on death and dying, truly one of the most important books of the last century, really became the touchstone for the national and international hospice movement, which has really humanized, again, you know, the way we relate to the dying and the way we treat them. The thing is, though, while Kubler-Ross was working on this, she wasn't just hearing stories about those psychological stages and the suffering associated with a terminal illness. She was also hearing stories that we now associate, you know, years later, with what we would call the near-death experience, right? Mm-hmm. So this is in the mid-60s to late-60s, about 10 years before the term near-death experience had even been coined. Nobody had heard of this. Nobody was talking about it. But she is hearing from patients who are saying to her, look, there's a story I need to tell you. You know I was resuscitated, right? And she's like, yes. And they would go on to talk about leaving their bodies, seeing the procedures that had revived them. They seemed to describe those procedures accurately. You know, Kubler-Ross worked in a hospital. She was an MD. She had familiarity with resuscitation procedures. They would talk about the other more dramatic stages associated with the NDE, too, as if leaving your body is not dramatic enough. You know, maybe you pass through a tunnel, you visit another realm, you see deceased loved ones, you meet with someone who is a stranger to you but seems to be some sort of spirit being, all these kinds of stories. And her first reaction was to dismiss them. I spent a long time interviewing her research partner, the Reverend Mwalimu Amara, who accompanied her on a lot of these, or most of these, really, excursions to interview people. And he, too, because it didn't fit, these stories didn't fit his paradigm of what would happen when you're supposed to die, when you die as a Christian, right? He also rejected these stories initially. You know, this just didn't fit with either of their experience. The thing is, they kept hearing these kinds of stories. And when they kept recurring, they eventually sat down and said, look, what are we going to do? And they decided, well, since the goal we took on here was to record the stories of the terminally ill, we need to write these down. We need to start taking notes. So they started taking notes on these events, and by the time she was commissioned to write on death and dying, she had enough material on them to write a whole chapter on death and dying about what we now call near-death experiences. So she did. The original manuscript for On Death and Dying had a chapter in it about what we now call NDEs, right? Mm-hmm. And also a phenomenon called deathbed visitations, in which people who are close to death feel that, report seeing other people in the room, and they're lucid enough to interact with the doctors and nurses and relatives around them who are living invisible, right? But they're also interacting with something else going on in the room. And so she had a whole chapter on these things. And the night before, literally, she was going to put this stuff in an envelope and stick it in the mail to her publisher, she met with Reverend Amara and said, you know, what are we going to do here? Should I include this? And he advised her against including that chapter because it would have torpedoed the larger argument they were trying to make, which is that we need to, you know, we need to listen to the dying. We need to treat them well and understand that they're still alive, you know, and we need to facilitate their life experience while they're still here, to whatever degree that we can. And the paranormal carries so much stigma with it that he felt, and I think he was right about this, that if she included that chapter, either the publisher might reject the whole book, or worse yet, they'd publish it. And with that chapter included, and people who would be resistant to her argument would say, look, she's just a crank. You know, look at this chapter. And they would never get anywhere. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross agreed with Reverend Amara, and that chapter was not, in fact, included when she sent it off the next day.
Well, she's a kind of cautionary tale, not so much because of this, because in the sense that she, you say in the book, Steve Volk, in your book, Fringeology, that I mean, she had clearly many, many experiences maybe that you couldn't explain, but the patients were reporting to her. But then she kind of went over, over to
so
the dark side.
So what happens is, On Death and Dying comes out in 1969. Mm-hmm. She becomes world famous. She does not out herself or out these experiences until 1975, when Raymond Moody asks her to write, gets in contact with her because he's about to write a book in which he first coins the phrase near-death experience. And Kubler-Ross agrees to write the foreword to it. And at that point, she is so vilified and faces so much criticism from her colleagues and from around, you know, the world, that she decides that she's got to have proof, you know, like real proof. And so she starts chasing these experiences. As Reverend Amara had put it to me, you know, we didn't go looking for these experiences. They just kept happening again and again to us. But when she faced this kind of, you know, mockery for coming out about it all, she decides she wants something. She's going to start chasing them. She's going to start chasing these experiences because she wants something she can wave in front of people and say, see, you know, deny this. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, she falls in with a con man named Jay Barnum. And Jay is an old, you know, medium kind of sideshow spiritualist who suckers her in and takes her for a ride. And for a long, long period of her life, then at that point, Kubler-Ross is really in exile because now she's at one point even, you know, running a ranch called Shanti Nalaya, at which Barnum works. And, you know, it leads to scandal and all sorts of other things. And it's all in the book. It's really an epic tale, the story of Kubler-Ross. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful story. But in this respect, it does represent a cautionary tale, because if you do start chasing these experiences and become too credulous in the process, you will get taken.
Yeah. Steve Volk. Stay tuned for more of our interview about his book, Fringeology, after the break.
The house looks just like the one next to it. And the one next to that. And the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so obnoxious.
With their three children. And something more.
Sweetie, remember last night? Do you remember when you woke up and you said you're here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you mean? Who's here?
TV
people.
Something's funny going on here next door. Something,
We were wondering if maybe you had experienced any disturbances lately.
What kind of disturbances?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We just heard a clip from the 1982 horror film Poltergeist, and we're talking with journalist Steve Volk about the paranormal. His book is Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. Your book deals with some of the most puzzling and compelling questions that we have as human beings, things like, what is consciousness? Is it connected to the physical body? Is there something separate about the mind? in terms of consciousness. And then you talk about a scientist named Hameroff, and you talk about quantum physics. For some of the more things that we don't understand yet, what are some of the emerging ideas in science and in quantum physics that might provide an indication that we're not just crazy when we come to things like precognition and the paranormal?
Well, look, I think that quantum mechanics remains mysterious enough that it opens the door to thinking that we will find explanations for these events. And indeed, you know, in that, find that they're really going on as well. You know, come to agreement where previously we've only been at loggerheads. And quantum physics has become this sort of great litmus test. There are the people who, like Deepak Chopra, for instance, who really point to it as holding the answer to, you know, all these sort of mystical concerns and issues. And then there are people like Lawrence Krauss who deny that quantum physics really holds any importance at all for, I guess the best way to term it is, our philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that weird things go on at the quantum realm, two particles that are separated by a distance are in fact, you know, can be connected, or the quantum tunneling effect, you know, where particles can actually go through, in essence, solid objects. All these various, and there's a ton, right, associated with quantum physics. He would claim that, you know, well, we have a good enough understanding of how these work, and we know that they only go on at the sort of the micro level of reality to know that they're not affecting us sort of up here. They have no significance at the macro level for how we think about the world and how it works. But I think the one thing that's really clear when you dive into it is that we don't really know yet. And I think that that is an argument that tends to run against the skeptics, because it leaves quantum physics open as a possible means of explaining how some of these things could occur.
We'll talk about
that. So, for instance, Stuart Hameroff in the book, I don't mean to cut you off, but Stuart Hameroff in the book talks about how, you know, it could be that consciousness, his theory is that consciousness has some sort of, it's quantum, ultimately, that quantum physics will explain consciousness, how the very physical matter in our brains and the physical interactions among chemicals and electrical impulses create something so non-physical as thought will ultimately be explained by quantum physics. That would be his position. He goes on from there at times, you know, much maybe to his detriment in some ways in scientific circles because of this taint, you know, associated with the paranormal, to say that these things might ultimately also explain telepathy or the near-death experience. Perhaps consciousness does continue on in that quantum realm after our macro level bodies, right, cease to exist, you know, or cease to operate. Let's put it that way.
Now I want to tell you a little bit about my story, because I think it kind of comes in here. I did have an experience once when I was renting a room in a house that I was living in. I hadn't gone into the room much before I rented it. I had just moved into the house. I brought in the prospective roommate. I opened up the closet to show her what it was, and we both saw the most bizarre thing I think I've ever seen in my life, which is something that had red eyes and just blackness around it.
Wow.
And we closed the door, looked at each other, acknowledged that we had seen something that we couldn't understand, and then went on as if nothing had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that months later, when my friend was experiencing a lot of pain, I had, I'm going to make this as quick as I can. All I can say is I laid my hands on her because somebody had taught me how to do that. And something came out of her and knocked me off my feet. Now, this is the very short version of this, but it really does get back to this idea of the disembodied consciousness, just as you saw a ghost at one time. I don't know how to process this, so I just haven't. I know it happened. I had independent confirmation with the person who was there with me. We acknowledged it and went on. You, how about yourself? now that you've done all this research and all this writing in the book Fringeology, how do you now process or think about what happened to you as a child?
That's a great question. And I think, by the way, what you describe is very common. You know, people just sort of go on. It wasn't as if my family obsessed over that ghost after it stopped. We would bring it up from time to time. When the movie Poltergeist came out, you know, it sort of became almost a Christmas movie for us. Whereas most families saw it as a horror story, we saw it as like, you know, hey, great, you know, somebody's really, you know, done this right. And so I mean, there were some changes there, you know, but for the most part, we just sort of went on about our lives. And the intriguing thing for me with this book was to wonder where it would leave me at the end, because certainly I've written enough stories over the years that I know that stories that aren't even that personal sometimes change me, you know. And so I did wonder, how am I going to come out of this? And I have to tell you, I look at the family ghost now as an incredible lesson in humility, because I do not know what the ultimate explanation of those events were. I do know that this, you know, it wasn't just superstition and creaking floorboards, right? And then beyond that, it's just this great mystery. And I use the word great advisedly, because I think we're far better off if we acknowledge mysteries in this world than if we simply wave our hand at them and deem them entirely insignificant or claim we have an explanation for them, when the real fact is we don't. And so I tend to look at that event now as the thing that clued me in to the sort of the true state of affairs, you know, and how we function and how we take mysteries and overlay them with what we either hope or wish or, you know, fervently believe is probably the explanation. And it's allowed me, I think, to embrace uncertainty, which is something that we're really not built to do, again, neurologically. You know, it's not what the brain prefers initially anyway, but I've really found that you can get used to it. And that's a wonderful sort of life skill when you think of how, that's why, you know, the book really isn't just about the paranormal. You know what I mean? It does go beyond that to sort of how we live and how we approach the world. So I can honestly say now that after all the research I've done into this, it's informed how I look at everything. I am far more willing now to admit when I don't have enough evidence to reach a firm conclusion. And I've grown more and more comfortable with that. And that is a tremendous life skill. There's a lot of things I get into later in the book, lucid dreaming and prayer and meditation, things that I've really adopted as a big part of how I live my life now. And so there's also those things I've brought along with me. But in terms of the ghost, the big thing is a sort of an appreciation for and a greater ability to acknowledge mystery.
That's quite wonderful. And we've been speaking with Steve Volk about his book Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Journalist Steve Volk. And we link to an excerpt from Fringeology at writersvoice.net. We also link to Volk's blog of the same name. Next up, the summer slide and some help in preventing it. Stay tuned. No more pencils, no more books, no more teachers' dirty looks. That's what we used to chant on the last day of school as we ran out to start summer vacation. But sweet as it is, the summer hiatus takes a toll on kids' academic skills. It's called the summer slide. For 20 years, Workman Publishing has been putting out an educational game called Brain Quest in the form of question cards that help to keep knowledge in kids' memory banks. Now they've added, of course, an app for iPhone and iPad and other tablets. I asked BrainQuest spokesperson and teacher Kim Tredick to explain what BrainQuest is.
BrainQuest is really a question and answer type flashcard game that's been around for 20 years. It's like the number one bestseller for educational toys because it's fun. And it's a series. They come in little boxes, tall, narrow boxes, with a deck, two decks that are attached so you don't lose any pieces. And there's a question set on one card, and then you slide the card over, and the card behind it has all the answers to those questions. The questions range in degrees of difficulty, so some are really simple and some are really difficult. They are based on grade level standards and national standards for the state. They are, if you're looking at kindergarten through seventh grade, they include questions on English, math, science, and history, and technology. BrainQuest also has cards that start for two-year-olds. They have the very first deck, which is twos and threes. And then they have a preschool deck, which is threes and fours.
So these are all about learning readiness, certainly in those age, and then about kind of maintaining kids' knowledge during the summer. Talk about the summer slide. What's that?
Okay, well, the summer slide is what we teachers see happen every year. When we come back to school in August or September, depending on when your school starts, it's like the kids have never been in school before. They've forgotten basic facts. They've forgotten grammar, facts, information in science that they learned the year before. And it takes a good month for them to get back into the swing of things and get back into the routine and actually things start clicking again. So there's a lot of review that is necessary at the beginning of the year.
Now, why does this happen? Is this because we have longer, in the United States, we have longer summers than, say, I think in Japan it's only a month, for example?
I don't know if it's the length or just the fact that we don't typically do anything for our kids during the summer. I mean, they go to summer camps, but most of us, and, you know, teachers, some teachers included, just like, yay, summer break, let's check out and turn off. And so I think that's what happens, is kids stop learning, they watch TV, they're playing games, they're playing sports, which are all great activities, but there are ways to turn your regular summer activities into a learning opportunity, and they don't realize they're learning.
I have an 8-year-old granddaughter. I'm sure she's going to experience some of the summer slides. She's going to be going into third grade. You know, I was reading them over, and I was thinking, is she going to kind of resent the idea that I'm trying to get her to remember things that she learned during the school year? How can I use these cards that really makes it fun rather than some kind of like, oh, grandma type of thing?
Right. The cards are naturally motivating. I have fifth and sixth graders in my class, and I have gifted kids, and I have kids who are at risk, who are, you know, have learning difficulties. And they are equally excited when I reach for my cards. Even though the material may be review material, they gain confidence and they love being able to answer questions. And it's just fun. My kids play against each other, but I have kids who will take the cards and study them because they want to get smarter. They think it's great to be able to answer all these questions. You know, it's the kid version of like a trivia game. And all of us feel great when we can answer questions like that. It's just fun. There are questions on there that are silly. There are questions on there that are really difficult, and you get genius points for those. It doesn't have the skill and drill kind of feel that other flashcards have.
And now these are pretty much about information. I mean, there are different kinds of learning. There's kind of learning how to learn, and then there's a basic store of information. Where are American kids when it comes to the latter, the kind of basic store of information?
I am surprised when I play with my BrainQuest cards and my kids how much information my kids know that I wouldn't expect them to know. They are little sponges, and they absorb what they hear from TV and the news and newspapers. I am impressed, and I think in today's current state where we're so focused on testing, we are trying to cram information into our kids. And I think what we need to do is step back a little and just teach our kids that knowledge is powerful and how do we need to go about learning knowledge. And if we can teach them to think and teach them to enjoy gaining knowledge, I think that those test scores are going to take care of themselves.
Yeah. So you mentioned before a little bit about the kind of drilling that happens in schools. You know, I've seen the worksheets. Sometimes I think, my goodness, if this is how I had, if this is what I confronted when I went to school, I don't think I would have experienced the love of learning that I did.
That is true. And I think the good teachers know that you can't just, you know, it's called skill and drill, but it's more like drill and kill. Because it really does turn kids off of work. They don't really learn from fill-in-the-blank sheets. There are appropriate times for skill and drill, such as learning your multiplication facts or learning the states and their capitals. But more learning will occur if we can give them a context in which to learn it and see that there's value in finding out the information themselves and pondering big ideas and wondering how these things came together. So I think that good teachers out there, and there are lots of great teachers out there, making learning fun by making it more challenging, more adventurous, and more applicable to the kid's life. They see how it's going to increase the value of their life by learning more.
You know, I remember, again, and, you know, this is, I don't even know if this book is still around. When I was a kid, one of my favorite books was called Fascinating Facts.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I do.
And I loved it. And this BrainQuest, these cards, reminded me of Fascinating Facts. Even though they're covering information that kids are supposed to have already known, they pique the interest.
Exactly. You know, one of the quotes that I've seen on one of the press releases from Workman Publishing was that it gives kids an opportunity to discover a new fun fact, and that's exactly what it is. It's, you know, even if they don't have the knowledge and can't answer the question, they do learn the new fun fact.
And now there is a BrainQuest app. I guess it was inevitable.
Yes, we got to keep up.
That's right. What is that app?
The BrainQuest app. What they've done is they've taken this question and answer type format and put it into an interactive, really fun, very colorful game. And it's a free app to download, and it's for iPhone, iPad, iPod, the Nook tablet, and the Nook Color. And in that game, there's a series of 28 levels for each grade level. And currently, it's for grades 1 through 5, and there are 600 questions. So the kids work their way through levels, and there's Wisdom Island and Snowy Mountain Pass and Space Voyage and things like that. And they work their way through these little adventure areas. And as they go, it's just like the BrainQuest cards where they have a question and then they're given an they're actually given a multiple choice answer format. And then, of course, you can, as you go through your levels, you can have an expansion pack that you can purchase. But the initial download is free for 600 questions.
Well, this is terrific. They are challenging. Some of these questions, I had to say, even on the fifth grade level, I couldn't remember.
Yeah. Well, you need to ask a 10-year-old.
Yeah, exactly.
We've forgotten some.
And Kim, tell us again where you teach.
I teach at Golden Oak Community School in Santa Clarita, California, which is in Southern California.
California has been hammered, and California schools, we've heard, have been hammered in terms of budget constrictions. I don't know if it's okay for me to ask you this, and if you don't want to answer, that's fine. But if you had some advice to California taxpayers and to the presidential candidates about school budgets, what would your advice be?
Well, we definitely need more money in education. And we're starting to see, I think, as a nation, that there is a crisis in education, that we are underfunded, and therefore we are falling behind compared to, you know, worldwide comparisons. And we need to make education a priority. And I think in education, we are working a whole lot smarter right now, but we are not, we're still not able to work under the funding that we receive. And federal funding is not sufficient for the federal programs that we are required to have at the state level. So we need to increase our federal funding for education so that our states, because what's happening in states is we are underfunded from our federal programs, so therefore we're using state money to fund federal programs, which leaves state money at a deficit.
Well, Kim Tredick, thank you so much. You're a teacher. You also are one of the consultants on the Brain Quest cards and app, the series here that's out from Workman Press. Thanks so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I needed to mention one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the 20th birthday for Brain Quest, they are doing some amazing things for students and teachers. If you go to brainquest.com, they have scholarship opportunities for students. In one of the grand prizes, a $20,000 scholarship. There's also a $5,000 scholarship and 18 iPads they're giving away for runners-up. And then for the teachers, they're choosing one teacher a month to have a $500 cash prize and then $500 worth of BrainQuest products for their school.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to choose a grand prize winner out of those 12 for a $5,000 cash prize. So a lot of happy things going on with that. And also Workman has a partnership with Chrysler to be able to do these college scholarships. So it's really exciting, brainquest.com. And like I said, 20 years, it's been a great product, and I've had them for 20 years. So makes learning fun.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again.
Thank you very much, and you have a great day.
Teacher Kim Tredick, spokesperson for BrainQuest. And by the way, and I'm not being paid to say this, since that interview, I tried the cards out on my granddaughter. And much to my surprise, she actually loved answering the questions. My guess is that they must stimulate the reward mechanism of the brain, or something like that. Next up, a Writer's Voice book review, after the break.
On the night that you were born, I looked out the window to the sky. And those brilliant stars sang to me as you uttered your first cry. I looked down into your face and saw stars shining in your eyes. My child of the stars.
In January 1945, the victorious Russians sent thousands of Romanian Germans to labor camps in the Soviet Union to rebuild the country that Hitler's armies had destroyed. German novelist Herta Müller has a personal connection to the story. Her mother was one of those prisoners. Müller's new novel, The Hunger Angel, is about a young man interned in one of the camps. It's just been released in translation in the U.S. Writer's Voice associate producer Drew Adamick has a review.
The Hunger Angel is Herta Müller's first novel after winning the Nobel Prize in Literature. Published in Germany in 2009 and recently released in English translation, The Hunger Angel is the story of 17-year-old Leo Auberg. Simply put, The Hunger Angel is a masterpiece. It is a novel of spare words and indirect glances that convey complex and lush meaning. It approaches the silence of the past, the deep pain of hunger, and meditates on the temptations and minute beauty of the natural world with a poetic touch that is simply breathtaking. Leo is a conflicted character, ashamed of and frightened by his homosexuality. He is deported to a Soviet labor camp for the crime of being an ethnic German in Romania at the end of World War II. Leo spends 5 years in the gulag, eventually returning home to find himself so changed that he is unable to reconnect with his life before the camp. Throughout the novel, Leo's suffering is seen through the objects he encounters. His soul-crushing labor in a coal plant becomes real through his love affair with a shovel. He languishes on the short life cycle of a barely edible weed as a symbolic comfort for his constant starvation. Müller writes with an achingly intense voice. She shows us Leo's anguish through his relationship with the physical world instead of telling us about the specifics of his torture. She avoids long, graphic renditions of suffering, rather drawing the reader into the Soviet labor camp with meticulously rendered detail. A light bulb becomes a beacon of hope. The ticking of a cuckoo clock becomes an instrument of torture. Death's arrival is announced with a thin, wicked smile of starvation on inmates' faces. Brilliantly and vividly constructed, the action of the story is told through insinuation and shadows. This technique allows the reader to become fully absorbed in Leo's world. Leo is both tethered to the suffering of his life and able to transcend it by his extreme attention to detail. By noticing the objects of Leo's world with the same level of attention, we come to share and recognize his suffering. His very hunger becomes our own. But this is not a novel of suffering or hopelessness. It is one of triumph and determination. Leo knows that he is going to survive, that he has to survive in order for his ordeal to have any meaning. Müller leaves the reader with the same grim determination. One comes away from The Hunger Angel with the sense that a life, no matter the circumstances, is measured by how intensely you live it in all of its glorious and gory details. For Writer's Voice, I'm Drew Adamack.
That was associate producer Drew Adamick with a review of Herta Müller's novel, The Hunger Angel. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamick is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.